You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Sunday, June 4th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
We're recording on Sunday because I'm going to be in Vienna all week.
You keep, like, bragging about
Austria,
this.
Yeah.
Just saying, going to be out of town. I got to go, you know, got to get the show produced before I leave.
When's the last time we recorded on a Sunday?
Oh,
it's been a very
long time. I don't know that we ever
have. Sunday.
Yeah,
Steve.
Right.
It's possible.
I don't
remember
that. This could be a first.
Steve, are you going to take in at least a symphony or a quartet? Are you going to go see some live music somewhere?
We're going to see Mozart and we're going to the opera.
Good. Good, good, good.
Yeah,
it's amazing because it's all in like these, you know, in Vienna. I've been to Vienna once and it was beautiful, of course. And you can see traditional music, Baroque music, whatever, all over the town, but a lot of times they're in these really old, beautiful churches, which it just adds to the experience.
Yeah, I need a vacation, especially since we just completed a major project, a super secret project that we've been working on for the last 6 months.
We're going to talk about it now?
Tell me.
We can mention it.
What? Wait.
Yay.
Let's do it.
All right.
Big deal.
So
okay.
we have written a book.
Woo-hoo.
SGU's written a book.
Yeah.
Yeah, guys.
We didn't want to talk about it until it was actually done. We're not writing a book. We wrote a book. It is done. we're still going to be going through the editing process and everything. We're working with the publisher.
Bah.
But the thing is done. It's huge.
It's going to take, just to give everyone like an understanding, it's going to take over a year.
Yeah, from this point.
It's on the shelves, right?
Yeah.
But we will be going on a whirlwind book signing tour. So you could come see us when we do the book signing because apparently we're contractually obligated to this. But come on, how many times do you get to say, "See you in 2 weeks, I'm going on a book signing tour"? I don't know. I kind of like
that.
For us,
Bob, you're going to be walking around Bob's office. He's going to be like, "Well, I got to go. I'm going on a book signing tour." Bob, I'm not going to tell
anybody
at work.
Work it.
And that's true, guys. If you think about it, have any of us written a book yet? I've written a chapter in a textbook, and I've written some journal articles. Steve, of course, has written many, you know, publications.
I had a blog post published a long time ago in a book, but that was about it.
I've had book chapters. I've never written
chapters.
Right. So this is
a full book. Yeah.
And a book for, you know, popular consumption, like a fun book.
Yeah.
I wonder what's this book about, anyway.
It's about critical thinking.
My favorite subject.
Let me see if I can summarize the book. It is a tell-all on Steve's weird sex life. No, this book is our story of our journeys in becoming skeptics and then everything that a critical thinker needs to know. Like as the, you know, critical thinking 101. If you digest the book and you absorb most of it, you will have an amazingly good understanding and backbone on science and critical thinking. Mostly critical thinking.
It's something of a skeptic's guide to the universe.
You might call it that. Skeptic's guide.
Interesting.
Which I thought of that.
To make things clear, Steve is the primary author because it had to be written in somebody's voice, and Steve is the most experienced writer out of all of us. But we were essentially Steve's support staff, his loving support staff.
His rogues, if it were.
Yeah.
I thought of that.
What Kara has now learned is that in any project, Steve needs someone to yell at while he's doing, you know, while he's working.
Several people.
Yeah, right, Ev? But we are so psyched. Like, we just can't wait for it to come out. And, you know, but there is a ton of work left. The publisher has to do a lot of things. We haven't even done any of the artwork yet or anything, but it's coming.
It is written.
It's a long process. Yeah, you think.
Yep.
That once the final word is done, that, you know, it's mostly done, but actually the publication process itself is long.
And I would dare say that in a couple of months, we're going to start writing book number two.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, it definitely is a lot of work. It was definitely a strain on all of our schedules to work this in. But it is the kind of thing, you know, once you do that, once you sort of build that into your schedule, there's no reason to just not keep doing it, you know? But we'll wait until the editing process is done on this one. And then we can start talking about what book two will be. I already have about a dozen ideas for what the follow up would be. You just have to decide how to prioritize it.
Haven't you ever heard of the concept of just resting on your laurels? Come on.
Wetting on your what?
You mean like Ridley Scott?
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of
poor multimillionaire Ridley.
We are about to launch a review on a movie called Alien Covenant, the second and the final, hopefully the final trilogy.
Hopefully it's not. Brand. You know it's not.
Close.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Now to start, I just want to start by saying this. The movie Alien and Aliens, which was the second one done by James Cameron, written and directed by James Cameron, is awesome. Those are fantastic movies. Yes. And as a very fun side note, when James Cameron went to the the money board, the people that were going to fund his writing and directing and producing the movie Aliens, this is what he did. He walked into a boardroom full of suits, wrote the word alien down on it, made eye contact, wrote the word S after the word alien, made eye contact, mm-hmm. then turned the S into a dollar sign, made eye contact, and smiled.
and walked out.
And they gave him the money. Or so the fable goes. But that's how awesome. He did it.
I love that story.
The movie is Alien Covenant. This is directed by Ridley Scott. And this is the sequel to Prometheus, which you may have enjoyed our review of that movie. We had a fun time.
Oh, yeah. I thought you were going to say you may have enjoyed that movie. I was confused. Yeah.
You may have.
That was possible. I got to say, Prometheus was the funnest movie to rip apart.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
I've been looking forward to the second one coming out so I could hate on it and kind of have a Prometheus repeat, right?
Yeah, this wasn't quite. I mean, this is better than Prometheus.
I would almost say it was significantly better than Prometheus. Yeah, it was still very, very bad, but it was significantly better than Prometheus. Yeah.
So, spoilers galore. You know, if you don't want to have this movie spoiled, we're not going to hold back. So just, skip to the end. So very quickly, this is taking place 10 years after the events in the movie Prometheus. And the basic plot line is that a colony ship, it's like 2,000 colonists plus 1,400 embryos, they get awakened from their slumber. They're being tended to by Walter, who is a robot, also played by David Fassbender, the same sort of model robot, although a subsequent
Michael
version.
Fassbender.
Mike, what did I say?
You said David because of David.
Oh, yeah, Michael Fassbender, who also played the role David. Yeah, so he's sort of tending the ship, and then I do like this part of it. So I think the science was pretty good. And the first 20 minutes of the movie, obviously it's science fiction, but I mean, the first 20 minutes of the movie is like, all right, this is going pretty well. I'm actually liking what I'm seeing so far. So
a couple of gotchas here and there, but we could talk about that later.
Yeah. Well, there's always some gimmies, right? All right. So the colony ship is jumping from system to system and then recharging its energy off of solar panels, inflatable solar panels.
Yeah, those were cool. They had like an origami vibe. Yeah.
So I like that idea, that you're sort of jumping from system to system and then recharging in each system. That was cool.
That's right. It's like an 8-year journey, so they have to.
Well, but you didn't really get the sense, though, that you were actually near in a system. I mean, you seemed to be in the depth of space.
But you weren't. You had to infer that you were because they get hit by a CME, right? They get hit by basically.
I think
a
they showed on some
ejection.
Of the radar screens and some of the holography screens that they were in another solar system. Like, not solar, but you know what I mean, a star system.
Stellar system.
Yeah, stellar system. They showed that.
Really? I mean, I don't know. There didn't seem to be anything nearby that they showed.
But Bob, you're right.
No, but the light had to illuminate the ship and the sail and everything. You had to sort of use your imagination just a little bit.
And they said, I mean, they did overtly say it, like, let's open up the sails to recharge.
I've got a real good imagination. Now, the thing is, they say, they kind of make you think, they make it kind of seem like a neutrino blast. So for a few seconds, I was like, whoa, neutrinos don't do that because they go through like light years of lead.
No, that was just the warning. Neutrino blast.
Right, that's
the warning.
You quickly discover that was really just a warning. But even what they say after that is a little bit confusing because they say the words stellar genesis. So that means that a star ignited.
But Bob, later they called it a CME. They physically said it was a coronal mass ejection. So, and they said it was a fluke.
They also said solar flare. So it is a little bit kind of like, well, what
I
exactly
think
was
they
this?
Yeah, they
meant,
got the jargon a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, I think they meant that it was a solar flare because they made it very clear that like all contingencies were planned for, and this was a totally random event that they could not have planned for. And yes, if it were a supernova, they would have seen that coming.
Right, but they said stellar genesis, so
yeah,
so
I think that was just
star ignited nearby.
I heard that too. And then I later interpreted that just to mean that it was stellar in origin, and not that it was the origin of a star. Because then otherwise it makes no sense when they start talking about, like, the neutrinos from stellar genesis are from a stellar origin. But then that was just the warning of a CME to come. That's a little bit wishy-washy. I get that. But I'm just giving them some benefit of the doubt there.
Okay, that's fine.
They parked near a star. They got hit with a CME. That all makes sense. You know, it was unpredictable. They have to park near a star because they have to recharge on the solar panels. So that so far, if you just ignore some of the terminology issues there, and again, these are not astronomers, you know.
It didn't seem like any of them were scientists on the ship.
Yeah, they're grunts. Okay, so they're crew. They know how to fly a ship. And so, fine. Okay, they were a little bit off with the terminology. So I was able to look past that. But I like if you piece that all together in the way that I said, I thought that was good. So the other good thing that they did was that they killed the captain in that accident. Although, you know, this gets to what I really don't like about the movie, which we'll get to in a minute. But it did raise the stakes. It made them all desperate. It sort of killed off the competent captain, and you were left in charge with number two in command, who was incompetent, which was good.
Yeah.
Because of what happens throughout the rest of the movie, they should have killed the entire crew. Yeah. They should have just had, like, the second string backup crew who never thought they would have been in charge running everything and being completely overwhelmed.
Yeah, but
that's how
happened.
Incompetent they were. The rest of the movie, everyone was so incompetent.
They were
Ripley number two. She was great. Well, she was the lead.
Yeah, I liked
her. She was okay.
She was meant to be the kind of unsung hero of the film.
Yeah, she was, of course.
She was the lead.
Sure, sure.
But didn't you think it was a little weird that the most famous actor in the entire movie was
in one scene?
The guy who was killed, like,
yeah,
really
James
bad.
Franco.
Yeah, he was in one flashback. It was weird.
I thought that looked like James Franco.
Why do that? Wow. Why? That's stunt casting. Why pull yourself out of the stupid movie with such a minimal little thing like that?
I agree,
that?
Bob.
I suspect that there were many more scenes with him that just didn't make the cut. That's the most likely explanation.
I suspect that they just couldn't afford him for more scenes.
More flashbacks
than that.
My interpretation was
they can afford whatever they want.
James Franco really wanted to be in the movie, and he, like, pulled strings to get, like, that super small part.
Yeah. And they were all like, yeah, you're not having a major role in this film because it would be silly. So we're just going to give you this flash.
So what can we give you?
Right, Kara, I got to admit, about halfway through the movie, I was sweating James Franco. I wanted him instead of these other idiots.
Bring the captain back.
They pick up a signal. Now, they're 7 years away from hitting the planet that they had significantly researched and chose to build this colony that they're ferrying.
Decades of research,
2,000 people to. They get this signal. It's a super weak, unintelligible signal. Maybe you pick up a word
almost
here and there. Almost, yeah. And they decide, or the new captain decides, we should go explore that. We really need to, because it's only a few weeks away, you know. But why didn't we find this planet? I don't know. It's weird, isn't it, that we didn't find this planet before? Why would there be a signal here?
They do recognize music playing over the signal, and it's John Denver. So it was a signal from Earth. It was Earth in origin. Yeah, So.
Well, it was somebody from Earth on one of these planets.
I agree. But this is not a rescue mission. This is a delivery of a civilization to a planet that was finally picked. So it was a horrible decision.
And again, that's what our hero, our female hero, warned against it and said, you know, I'm going on record to officially say we should not do this.
Hey, it's in the log.
Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah, he logged it. That's true.
This is a backup. This is basically a backup of humanity. So you don't mess around with that. That's kind of important, you know, not having all your eggs in one basket type of scenario. That's kind of where the idea that you get. So, you know, you just go where you planned on going.
It's not just that. There was 2,000 lives at stake with a bad decision.
All right. They sort of justified it, though, because, you know, when the CME hit, the pods failed, and Franco's set on fire. He burned to death in his pod, and everyone was freaked out and didn't want to get back in the pods. So it's like, do you really want to go back in a pod for 7 years, or you want to take a 3-week jaunt to this planet, which looks awesome?
Yeah,
so
it
they
looks like it can
sort
sustain
of justify it. Yeah.
Human life. Yeah, they were like, it's right in the habitable zone. It's got everything we need.
And
but
that
which
right, and that leads to two, I think, fairly decently sized science screw ups. Right.
Yeah. What, the fact that they didn't wear spacesuits when they walked right out onto the planet? Okay,
all
right.
We're not even there yet. We haven't even landed on the planet yet.
Yeah, so here are the two that I see. First off, you know, generally, you're traveling to a planet, changing your momentum and your destination to go to another star, that's probably not going to happen. You know, we don't know much about their what kind of rocket engines they have, but you have a certain amount of fuel. You're not probably not going to pay for all the extra fuel you would need to actually change your destination.
I think they made it pretty clear that their ship itself could recharge.
No, that doesn't mean much. That doesn't mean anything, because recharging the batteries, whatever. But they probably have some fuel for fusion engines or fission engenes. I mean, that this is you're going to need
be nuclear.
Fuel.
We were supposed to suspend disbelief a bit on that.
Well,
2107.
Okay, right.
It's 100 years in the future.
That's fine, but I'm just saying that what physics would say about this is that you're going to have fuel. You're not going to charge batteries really, and then use that as rocket engines. You're going to have fuel. You're going to need. There's no way around the fuel.
But it's not as if they were like traveling fast in one direction and had to change their momentum. You get the feeling like they jump to a system and then they're just at that system. They're not really going anywhere until they're ready to jump to the next system.
Yeah, it's a rest stop.
So,
they
didn't have to change their momentum.
That's a little ambiguous.
I agree with you, Bob. And I don't think 100 years of rocket technology is going to make the fact that they're going to be doing a huge spend of energy trivial. Because you can't collect enough electrical energy.
What I'm saying is we don't know. We don't know how much energy they would have had to spend.
They were smart because they just completely neglected to mention any of that.
Right. Yeah,
so
you're right.
There was nothing to rip apart. Yeah.
And the second thing that is very subtle, remember when they said where the planet was and they used right ascension and declination?
Yeah. She didn't say declination.
Yeah, terrestrial
that's
terms.
Wrong. That's Earth-based.
Earth-based. But she also didn't even say declination. She said declination or something super.
Oh, did she?
She said declination.
I picked that up.
You know what?
Yeah.
People that mispronounce words, that is so lame.
I know. If you're going to be in a film and you're using a technical term, like make sure you know how to say it.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
And it was voiceover. It was Mother that was saying it. It was the ship's voice. So it wasn't in scene. They could have fact-checked that and just retaken it easily.
Yeah, basically, to me, that means they did not have science advisors or they did not listen to them. Because that's a minor mistake, but it's like, damn, you know, that's really
it's
big.
But Bob, they make some epic mistakes coming right up. There were no science advisors.
So, Bob, what's funny is my daughter, Julia, made the same observation. She said they used right ascension and declination incorrectly. But I said, yes, those are terrestrial-based terms, but you could maybe they have a system that they transpose into outer space that uses the same terminology.
Yeah, it would have to be Milky Way-based, but...
Yeah, something. So you can sort of give them a pass on that
it's just a way to express a certain direction.
All right. You're right. They probably just were using fancy words that they didn't understand.
They travel to the planet. They orbit huge vessel that's carrying 2,000 people in suspended animation. They orbit it.
It's called the Covenant, by the way.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And they take a little puddle jumper ship down, like a cruise ship down, and pretty much
lander.
Almost
reminded me of Aliens 2, or Aliens.
Now, keep in mind, the people that were awoken out of like their long term sleep was the
thrown
crew
out of their beds.
This is the crew that's hired to fly the ship. That's part of actually. So most of the crew gets on this ship to go explore the planet. They're leaving a few people left in the big ship. Yeah.
Two people. No, three. Three people behind.
Yeah, right. Three people behind.
So
and Mother.
They land on the planet. Now, Kara, this is the part where you do what? You land on the planet and you put on a what?
A spacesuit.
Good
spacesuit. And maybe you do some chemical testing of the gases to make sure.
Can't you do that you can do that from the ship.
You could do
assume.
That from the ship, but they just walk on out, breathe in the air. They're like, oh, it's in the habitable zone. Must have the same air
that's
composition.
That's great. Oh,
as
and it has almost one, yeah, and almost 1G, so we're good. Let's go. Let's go for a walk.
They did the same thing in Prometheus. They just took off their helmets. They didn't even bother putting them on.
Yeah, they didn't even bother putting them on.
Ridley Scott probably hates his actors being in spacesuit props. That's what I think.
You
have to do is just time splice a little. All right, we are doing the super careful analysis to make sure that this planet is safe for us before you walk out, rather than just going out onto the surface with no indication that they did any kind of analysis. So this is we're getting up to the big problem with this movie, and the thing that I think crippled it, which is the same problem that, shockingly, the same problem Prometheus had. it may even be worse in this movie. So you have a crew of people. Yes, they lost their captain, but you have the crew of people whose job it is to keep, again, this backup of humanity alive and get them to a colony world and then reboot a civilization on the colony world. So presumably they've been trained and they have some skills. And they were, you know, so incompetent every step of the way. It was unbelievable. They just lazily drove the plot by having the characters be stupid.
I think some of them were more stupid than others.
Yeah, sure.
And I think they did a good job of making the grunts the ones
who kept making the dumb mistakes. The military guys were
the ones making the bad mistakes.
Yeah, I'm going to go
and
take a piss by myself, but I'm really going to have a smoke. And then
I'm
going to go wash up.
Yeah, whereas the woman who wanted to do the botany samples was much more careful. She was much like, the woman who ended up dying in the med bay. Who did all the botany samples? I didn't find her to be a stupid character. I found her to be quite a strong character.
You're right, Kara, but the problem is that largely many bad decisions were being made. I mean, just riddled.
Absolutely.
This is the part of the movie where anybody that has any knowledge of science or has heard our Prometheus review would be going, what the hell is going on here? Seriously, these guys have to have some type of protocol. They should have some type of safety mechanisms in place. And they did. So
yeah, they had none.
If you ever play D&D, tabletop D&D, the one thing that you learn after playing the game for a short amount of time is the party should not split up. Don't split up. The first thing they did, they drop the gangplank, they walk off, everyone's got their weapons. They split up like 10 minutes later. They're splitting up. I have to gather some biological samples. You know. Me and this other guy, this red shirt. See this guy? He's wearing a red shirt from Star Trek, the original series, which means he's going to die. He and I are going to stay here. The rest of you go on off.
I guess that doesn't bother me as much because it is in service to the plot. The plot is that everything's going to go to hell in a handbasket. We know this is going to happen. Technically, Alien is a horror film, not necessarily. It's a sci-fi / horror film.
Right.
And
it's a thriller,
so we
too,
know
yeah.
that bad stuff is going to happen.
Kara, but think of the best sci-fi horror movies of all time. Alien is among them, as is John Carpenter's The Thing. And what those movies have in common is that the characters were reasonably smart and they were up against either an impossible situation or there was somebody effing with them and they didn't know about it.
I think they tried to
they failed.
Impossible situation was these genetically engineered creatures and David having ultimate control over them. There was no way that even if they had gone in and been a little smarter that they would have gotten out of there okay. So I think that
I'd like to see that movie.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. The failure is that they released these little weird black things that went into their noses. Like, I don't understand the point of them having to release the spores. They could have gotten infected a different way where it wasn't their fault.
They would have probably gotten infected in several different ways.
Exactly.
Because the idea here is, from what I understand, and I think David, the synth, had a lot to do with this, was that there was no wildlife left on the planet because
non-botanical wildlife.
Yeah, like there, you know, anything that was like, you know, a mammal.
So. No animals.
There no animals. Animals. That was not plant matter.
Yep, got infected.
No meat.
Got infected because he's testing. This synth is actually evolving the virus. And what's cool is, and this was the one thing I liked about the movie, is that synth actually created the version of the aliens that we see in the movie Alien and Aliens.
Yeah.
Like that man-like alien is his construct. He took the original alien DNA wherever it came from, and he evolved it.
He hybridized it with human beings. Like, he did this cool hybridization using the captain of his ship, which we find out is like a big reveal, I guess.
From the previous
There were no reveals in this. That was another thing that bummed me out. You saw every single thing coming.
Oh, gosh. I'm 3 miles away.
Especially the final reveal. Yeah. Was like,
as soon as he took the... he had
as
different
soon as
hair.
He cut his hair. Here yeah, exactly.
Here we go. Okay, we'll get to that, I'm sure. But oh man, that disappointed me like more than anything.
Why didn't we like the characters?
I'm going to fight back a little because I actually liked the lead.
I liked her, but nobody else. I couldn't.
She was the most tolerant.
No, I also really liked Michael Fassbender. Yes. He was amazing in this.
I amend those two. I love him. Yeah, I will watch him read the phone book. I love him.
But death to any movie, to any story, is that you don't connect to the characters. If a character dies... Now, I'm not talking about some schlub in three rows back on a horse that you never... No, but these are the primary characters. These are like the 8 or 10 characters that are driving the entire movie that we're going to, you know, no big surprise here. A lot of them are going to die. So I need to, as the audience member, care about them or else I don't care about the movie.
Think about aliens. Think about aliens. The characters in Aliens. I loved every goddamn one of them and I hated when they died. Game over, man.
Yeah, that's true.
Even Bill Paxton's character, who was the a-hole in the beginning of the movie, the utter a-hole that was like the jerk, the bully from high school type character, you love him at the end. Why? Because his character evolved during the movie. He had an arc. Even that secondary character had an awesome, cool,
and he was hilarious.
Yeah, and he was hilarious.
Danny McBride was supposed to be that character in this film.
Oh my gosh!
He fell flat. That's true. But I do. And it's so funny because it sounds like I'm defending this movie, and I, of all of us, probably hated it the most. I think what I'm defending is sort of a genre-specific issue. I don't think we need as much of that in a good horror film.
Well, I don't necessarily agree because, first of all, just connecting to the characters raises the stakes. It makes you care more. So you feel it more. You're feeling more about what's going on. But here's the problem. The expendable character thing, that's more of like a high school slasher type of movie.
I don't know. I think that's just horror genre.
But it doesn't work here because we're looking at people that are supposed to be intelligent. Yet again, they're supposed to know. They have protocols. They know when they land on a planet that they have to check the environment. They can't just jump off and be in the water of that planet.
Or find the mega ruined city with 18 million cadavers lying around in an enormous giant alien spaceship, which they totally missed from whatever cursory analysis they did of this world.
I have two comments that I got to make now. So if you hopefully you saw the movie, so you understand what I'm saying. But there's two synthetic humans in this movie, and they look identical to each other. One of them is a later version of the other, but they came from the same mold or whatever, however you want to say it.
Yeah, the new model, older model.
The older one had long hair down to his shoulders, where the new one had like a more of a military, very, very short haircut. Now, as soon as the other synth, the older synth, who was questionable from the beginning, because he was on the planet, they didn't think they were going to find anybody on here, really. Like, they weren't expecting a synth to be on here. But they find a synth, and he cuts his hair, so you can't tell the difference between him and the synth that they've been traveling with.
Well, you knew right then and there exactly what was going to happen. Yeah, but you knew what was going to happen.
At that
right
point,
then and there.
Any reasonable person that's in that crew would go, why did that synth make it so I can't tell the difference between him and the other guy that looks just like him?
That's when I spray painted his face.
Yeah, exactly. All right. I hated that because it was so obvious what he was going to do. And then he does it, and you're like, oh, really? Oh, God, he pretended to be the other guy. I'm shocked. Now, here's
Not just that.
They don't figure it out the last 10 seconds of the movie.
He obviously was sinister from the beginning. Like, there's all these clues that he, like, doesn't give them enough information. He's like, and they're like, what's going on here? He's like, I won't tell you, but follow me into this deep, dark cave so I can explain it to you. And everybody's like, oh, okay. Works for me.
So real I'll bring you to that point. So what happens is two people in this crew that get off the jump ship, they get infected because they kick the plant or the guy whatever touches it and these spores go in and they very quickly they get infected and aliens come out of them, like these little alien dudes. They're not really like the humanoid ones, more like ones that run on four legs.
But they're like babies.
Yeah.
Like little babies.
They're like homunculi. They look like grown-ups pretty much, but tiny.
a horror movie trope happens that utterly blew my mind, where I deadpanned Steve, who was sitting next to me in the theater, because I couldn't believe, because this is my go-to like shit writing joke for sci-fi, I'm not sci-fi, but horror movies in general. Yeah. It's when one of the dumb characters goes, I'm going to take a shower over there alone.
I have to go wash up. Yeah,
if you're hearing me, bad guy, I'll be over there alone, naked, bathing myself. So it's like, I get why some directors do this, because they like, oh yeah, they'll get a young, hot-bodied person, and they're washing, and then they that's like the first guy that gets killed.
They didn't even make her hot.
Right, but this girl goes and literally is washing her wounds in alien water, and water from a planet that they don't know anything about. She's washing her wounds in it alone after, like, these aliens came to hunt them down and kill them. Literally, like, killed one of the guys, bit one of the synth's hands off. Like, it was bad. Now,
also, I don't know if you guys noticed, the scream happened after the decapitation. I didn't quite understand. Subtle, but it did happen.
So there were so many wasted opportunities in this movie. They could have made the stakes so much higher. All it would have taken was, even again, nobody did this. If they had, they were all instantly at ease, you know, once David rescued them. Mm-hmm. And if there was even the slightest bit of paranoia, or can we trust this guy and what's going on, there could have been all kinds of controversy about whether or not you should trust him. And that could have planted doubt in the mind of the audience, because he was, you know, instead he was relentlessly creepy from the get-go, and they were just going along like sheep. And then the other big thing that I thought was missed was when it became clear that, you know, there are aliens busting out of crew members' bodies, and David's, oh yeah, the virus, it's killed everybody, you know, it was an accident. And the whole planet, every living thing on the planet's gone. None of them, not one person said, do you think that we should risk bringing this back to our colony ship with, you know, thousands of people up
there
totally vulnerable? Think about the dilemma that would have created. There should have been one person fighting for, no, we're dead. Now we live on this planet. We should just send the Covenant away because we're done. There's no way we can get back up to that ship and be 100% sure that we have not infected it with this
contamination
virus.
Contamination, right, is a sure word.
Two things. I would say in reaction to your first question or your first comment, I agree. Like, the creepy David should have, you know, piqued some people's concern.
Yeah.
But if they wanted to go the route where everybody was calm around him, they should have at least had some sort of conversation about the fact that a synth was made to serve man, or like,
yeah,
they should have made it so that there it was a non-issue, like, oh, there's no way he could be bad,
right,
because he's a synth. But they never even pointed that out, so it's like,
yeah,
you're left having to invent
lost
that for yourself. Yeah,
right. Yes.
Second, I will say, the girl who died really early on, who was with the infected guy and the botanist woman
on the lander, yeah,
she actually was concerned, and she put them in quarantine. Like, she actually made that point multiple times. This needs to be quarantined. This needs to be quarantined. But then she died within 5 minutes, and then it was never spoken of again.
Yeah, plus
so
she
I think
had
that
blood
was
on her face and didn't quarantine herself, but that's okay.
That's true.
Yeah,
no,
right.
I agree. I agree. But at
she
least
was just
to
panicking.
Some extent. She was panicking, but
yeah,
over and over
it.
On
totally
comms, they kept saying the word quarantine.
No,
that
they,
was
what,
actually
what
a
they said, Kara, was, should we quarantine? They questioned. It was raised
true
as a question
true
once. And then ignored. That was
okay
it. No,
I'll give
just
you that.
Raised it as a question
my
once
God
and then ignored it.
I'll
and
give
Steve,
you that. Yeah.
Steve, you're right. They should have said at some point, yep, we crossed the line. We can't get back to the ship because there's a chance we're going to ruin our entire mission. But even if they did that, the unprofessional crew left on the main ship still would have gone down and grabbed him because, you know,
yeah,
my wife is on the planet and I need to risk everything to save my wife. You know, just completely
unprofessional. Even after you found out that she was
even
dead.
After she's dead. And he overrode Mother, who is the, like, the brains of the ship, when she
yeah
said, if we go that low, you will risk massive catastrophic structural damage to the ship. He's like, I don't care. Let's do it.
I don't care. Yeehaw. It's like
so
riding the bomb
stupid
down the planet.
The other two, they fought, they pushed back, but then they acquiesced.
Yes.
They should have mutinied against that guy and not let him
absolutely
do it. And then, whatever. I mean, that should have been much more desperate, much more contentious. Compare that to the movie John Carpenter's The Thing, where everything is so contentious because the characters are truly desperate. And they're all smart, but just have different ideas about what they need to do in order to survive the situation. And there was none of that in this movie. That they went out of their way to keep the stakes low and to avoid conflict. And everybody was just dumb and going with the flow and making stupid decisions.
Because it's all about jumps. It's all about gore. It's all about these moment-to-moment, like, ugh! Whereas I feel like what's missing in modern horror is the Hitchcockian stress, just this long, intense anxiety going out through the whole film. Like, this movie didn't make me anxious once. I was like, okay, now this is going to happen. Okay, now that's going to, oh yeah, now he's going to die. And oh yeah, okay, she's setting herself up to die. Like, it was a bummer. There was no stress.
And they blew every reveal. They didn't. They didn't milk it. They didn't set it up properly so that it was a reveal. It was, you know, it was obvious. Again, even the really interesting bits that I like the fact that, oh shit, David is the guy who actually engineered the alien. That's that was cool.
That was a cool idea.
But that was, they wasted that really. They managed to minimize the impact of that. And then you know, of course, like the first time we see the eggs, the audience knows what they are. The characters don't know what they are, but, you know, David again lures the acting captain over to one, and he was so stupid. By then, you're like, yeah, just kill him. Just please kill this guy.
Right. Put your face down in there. Get the face hugger on your face. Like, you know it's going to happen. Why did David help them kill the alien?
Right.
Why did he pretend to be Walter the whole time on the ship when they were like, their lives were, why didn't he just let the alien wreak havoc? I don't get it.
No, because
he had
two embryos in him, and he had to do was get them into cryo. He'd been whatever. Yeah, help them.
That was
do everything he can to convince them that he's Walter and everything is good. Once they're in cryo, he owns that ship.
Why didn't the mothership realize that was David and not the other synth? How is that even possible?
And also, how did the other synth, or how did David, who predates Walter, know Walter's code?
Yep. Good question.
That made no sense. I mean, no sense.
He could have killed the other one and downloaded him on a thumb drive.
I don't know, maybe.
Yeah,
I guess we have to just assume that's what happened.
So like, that reveal at the end where they reveal that David had taken Walter's place was so obvious. It was so obvious that I naively was thinking, all right, well, obviously it can't be that simple. So they're gonna do a double switch here.
Yeah, exactly.
They're going to, you know, she must know that that's David and she's got something up her sleeve for him. But then, like, he'll switch or whatever. They got to do something. It can't be just that.
And then it ultimately is Walter, and he was pretending to be David, pretending to be Walter, and then, you know, or something.
Why didn't anything, she test him? Why didn't she even look under his chin? She wouldn't have known that. But why didn't she test him or do something to determine?
Yeah, still, why didn't she find out until she was locked in the damn pod? Right. Like, until it was too late.
Lock him up, and then ask him the question that only David would know, hopefully, you know? Like, he didn't know about the cabin by the lake.
Yeah. I mean, I like...
Yeah, and the fact that so many people that I've talked to who saw the movie all had that thought, to me, that's a failure of the storytelling.
Oh, it's total fail. It's total fail.
Big fail.
So this weekend, after you hear this, if you want to see a good movie that's got great action and doesn't pull its stupid shit like this
Wonder Woman.
Go see Wonder Woman. Absolutely.
Awesome. It was an awesome
Fantastic movie. Saw it last night. Wonderful.
Yeah, maybe we can review that again, or review that soon, too. That'd be good.
It had a few problems, but it was a good movie.
It was solid. That was a very good superhero movie. Good superhero movie. I mean, I admit that the bar is high because this is in the Alien franchise, and both Alien and Aliens were awesome movies. And so, yeah, you absolutely are being judged by that. Plus, it's also Ridley Scott. You know, he did The Martian. Yes. He did Aliens. He did,
He
did Alien.
Gosh, he's hidden this.
There's one thing we didn't bring up that, well, I also think he's like pretty far past his prime, but there is one thing that we didn't bring up.
He is 80.
That has always bummed me out about Ridley Scott is that he cannot help but infuse his religiosity into his films. And you find it in almost every one of his pure sci-fi movies.
Less so this one than the Prometheus.
No, there was,
it was so heavy-handed in this movie.
It was heavy-handed because the captain, the captain who became the captain after the first captain died, they had a whole thing about how he had faith, and they thought he wouldn't be able to be a good captain because they don't trust people with faith, but he's going to prove them wrong. Like, it's, he always works it in. He even worked it into The Martian in a way that was actually, I think, kind of sacrilegious to the original film, no pun intended, or to the original book, in that he took two actually blasphemous references, funny blasphemous references from the book, and made them kind of sacrosanct in the movie, which was annoying. But he did it in this movie too. He cannot help but do a movie and add some religious influence to
it. Well, right. And nobody mentioned this so far, but within the first, like, I think, minute of this movie, I was talking out loud already, because Wayland mentions, remember, he's a kind of a throwaway comment about not buying the coincidence of human evolution. And yeah. I just had to say out loud, yep, deal with it. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
That's
ridiculous. Yeah.
Really? Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm with Evan. I'll give it like a 3.2 out of 10.
Yeah, I think that's good, because the blood and the gore was good. I personally quite liked the Watterson character, Catherine Watterson's Daniel's character, and I thought that Michael Fassbender's character study was really interesting. And so they were entertaining to me, those three characters, David, Walter, and Daniels, and that at least carried me through.
Yeah, there were some things to enjoy in the movie. It wasn't horrible from beginning to end like Prometheus was, but the unfortunately, the bad stuff built up throughout the course of the movie. Then about two-thirds of the way through the movie, I couldn't care about anything anymore.
That's true. I was quite bored. Like, the movie was boring to me. It didn't really hold my attention that much.
All right. A disappointing film, I think, overall. All right. Now that that's done, let's go on to some news items. This first item is actually quite interesting. Have you guys heard that they have isolated proteins from T-Rex fossils?
Whoa. Yeah, but isn't that bullshit?
Yeah. So that's old news. And it's probably not true. So, but this has been going around. This has been going around for years. You know, they've been reporting.
Yeah.
There were actually two different samples where the researchers claim, first from a T-Rex, and then that was 68 million years old. And the second one was a 78 million year old specimen of a Brachylophosaurus. The lab claims that they were able to isolate collagen, which is the most common protein in the body. However, no other lab has been able to do so. That's a huge red flag, right?
Yeah, it's not a good sign.
Ding, huge.
Yeah, so the original lab that did this was run by Schweitzer. And other labs were unable to isolate the protein. And there was a suspicion that with the T-Rex specimen, that it was a contaminant. It could have been, for example, bacterial film on the specimens. And then with the second specimen, the suspicion was that it was a contaminant from the equipment, because that lab and that same equipment has been used to isolate proteins from ostrich samples previously. Mm. Yeah, you got some ostrich in your Brachylophosaurus samples.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, the just straight up reporting that proteins have been found, you know, in T-Rex fossils has been reported widely without the fact that most other scientists don't buy it, you know. Mm. All right. So now the news bit, there was a study published by Michael Buckley and his colleagues. And they sequenced the proteins, the collagen that was reported, you know, by the Schweitzer group, and they made a comparison to several species of ostrich, three mm-hmm. different species of ostrich, and they found that the protein, the amino acid sequences in that protein, were identical. They weren't similar; that they were identical.
Okay. T-Rex was an ostrich. Wow.
Yeah. So even though, you know, birds are avian dinosaurs, that they are they're closely related, there's basically no chance that a collagen, which isn't that particularly conserved, that the collagen protein between a T-Rex and an ostrich would be identical. So, I mean, Buckley et al., they're very cautious in their conclusions. They don't say this proves that there's contamination. They just say, this means we got to be really careful before we make any conclusions from this other research. And it suggests that cross-contamination cannot be ruled out, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
So if you can't rule out cross-contamination, then Occam's razor favors cross-contamination because the notion that soft tissue could survive for 68 to 78 million years is absolutely an extraordinary claim. Yeah. So, yeah, I agree with those who are skeptical of this. And this latest study puts another nail in that coffin. I don't know if it's the final nail. I don't know how Schweitzer is going to react to that. I always wait and see what does the other side have to say, you know, and then I usually don't declare a controversy over until the other side relents, assuming that we're dealing with scientists and not pseudoscientists. You know what I mean? They're never going to relent when you're talking about things like vaccines and autism. You're never going to get that from the other side. But among scientists, you know, when there's an actual legitimate controversy, then you get more data comes in. Eventually, everyone agrees, okay, this is the answer. I'm still kind of waiting for that. For example, like on The Hobbit, is it a real species or is it diseased humans? I think it's the data is piling up that it's a real species, but I haven't heard the other side relent yet. I'm still waiting to hear that happen, but we'll see. So I think that we're there with the T-Rex proteins, but be very interesting to see if Schweitzer. I mean, she's got to acknowledge, yeah, that's a problem. But the lack of replicability also a problem, but I don't. As far as I've seen, she hasn't given up on her claims. But you know, the important thing is though that you know when the media reports on this, that they note this is not generally accepted. This is one lab that hasn't been replicated, and you know there's strong evidence now to suggest cross-contamination.
So we'll see if they actually do that.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, The Great Courses Plus.
Here at SGU Central, luckily, we have this unlimited access to The Great Courses Plus's library, and that's why we get to see all of this awesome material, and we tell you when we find something that we find particularly awesome. And this week, we did find something really cool. Steve, tell me all about it.
Yeah, so we've been watching The Theory of Everything, The Quest to Explain All Reality. It's a great way to basically it's a whirlwind tour of the world of physics, but the approach is to show how our quest for knowledge explains the universe in deeper and more comprehensive way. It is like we're moving towards a theory that will explain everything, and we're obviously not there yet.
Mm.
It casts the quest for knowledge in physics and cosmology as that quest towards understanding everything. And I like that approach. It works really well.
And what's weird is at the end of that video, the guy that gave the lecture actually told Steve where his missing car keys are.
It really is a theory of everything.
And guys, even if physics isn't your thing, although physics is everybody's thing, there are so many more topics to choose from. There are, what is it? I think 8,000 different videos to choose from. And it's everything from what we think of as traditional kind of academic knowledge, like astronomy, physics, philosophy, psychology, but then also a lot of really useful everyday knowledge like cooking and photography.
As a listener of The Skeptic's Guide, we want you to sign up for The Great Courses Plus. Try it free for a month by using the special URL thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
So get your free month. You will love it. We can guarantee it. Sign up now for thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics. Remember, it's thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Bob, I understand they've discovered yet another gravitational wave.
Yes, LIGO has detected the third set of gravitational waves caused by, of course, merging black holes that send ripples through space-time from billions of years in the past. Now, what's that saying? Once is chance, twice is coincidence, three times is a pattern. Houston, we have a pattern. So I'm sure you remember LIGO that made that amazing discovery that was announced last year. Just a quick overview. LIGO is the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. They've got two facilities that are 3,000 miles apart, and they use interferometry, and they split basically laser beams, sending them down two separate long tunnels at 90 degrees to each other, and then these beams bounce back, and they rejoin, perfectly canceling each other out. Essentially because they've traveled the same exact distance. But if these ripples in space-time do exist, then one tunnel is going to be minutely smaller. And by minutely, I'm talking, comparable to the diameter of a proton. I mean, crazy, crazy tiny that you could really never measure any other way. But they can be revealed by these light beams that won't cancel each other perfectly, meaning that there is a difference in the length. of the tunnels. Now, of course, as you could imagine, that is incredibly difficult to pull off. They had to make, it's essentially the most sensitive instrument ever created in order to pull this off. I mean, they had to account for things like, you know, like wolves walking in the nearby grounds of one of the observatories. I mean, they had to account for a laundry list of these incredible things that are happening just to completely isolate it and let this happen. And they've done it. And this is the third discovery. Now, the first discovery was back in 2015, and it was momentous. And you should celebrate it every year because it really was a big thing. It not only showed that Einstein's prediction was correct, but it was the first direct evidence of black holes. Hello. That's pretty amazing and kind of shocking because you think, oh, we already knew about black holes, but we did, but we didn't really have direct evidence like this. And the other thing, this ushered in the new era of gravitational wave astronomy, a completely new discipline in astronomy. How often does that happen? Not very often. So now this latest detection is notable in a few ways for sure. It was detected earlier this year on my dog Molly's birthday, January 4th. Happy birthday, Molly, back then. This was 3 billion years away, making it the most distant of the three detections. And the resulting merged black hole was 50 solar masses, which is in between the first two. The first one was 60 solar masses and the second one was 20. So this is in between there, 50. The two most important takeaways from this latest detection are these. Before the first detection, astronomers did not expect that black holes with masses that, you know, as high as, you know, 40, 50, 60 solar masses could be created that way. So now, after just three detections, we have two that are in the 50 to 60 solar mass range. So that's it's not a coincidence. That's probably very common, and that was completely unexpected. And secondly, the other good takeaway here is that there's evidence now for a black hole spin from this latest detection. We really didn't have much of evidence as we do now. But not only that, the spin of at least one of these black holes around its own axis does not match the joint orbital axis of the two black holes. So that's pretty cool. So the future such detections then could potentially help us elucidate how such pairs of black holes form in the first place. So those are the two big takeaways as I see it. The future certainly looks bright for this technology. There's great hope that in the future they're going to detect one or two merging neutron stars. And that could, of course, help give us more information on extremely dense states of matter like neutron stars. Also, this is interesting. Check this out. We may find once we detect neutron stars colliding, that there's this unique light signature that we could use conventional telescopes to find these things. So you don't even necessarily need LIGO to find neutron stars that are colliding. Maybe, who knows? But that's just a possibility. And longer term, longer in the future, we may have something called ELISA that will be essentially three satellites that are at that form an equilateral triangle. These three satellites would be farther apart than the orbit of the moon. So as you might imagine, that could give us an interferometer that is exquisitely sensitive. You know, that could help elucidate not only black holes, but also potentially even microseconds after the Big Bang itself. You know, the European Space Agency is talking about this, and they're planning it. And potentially right now, I think the date is 2034. So, you know, all the preliminary tests look great, but we're going to have to wait, you know, more than a decade before we see that. But watch out. That's going to be intense.
Yeah. So, I mean, it sounds like we're just going to keep discovering them. Yeah. You know? So,
yeah,
obviously, this is not that rare an event. You know, you've three in now, how many years?
The end of 2015. So, yeah, not much time at all.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Okay, Evan. So I understand that Robert Bigelow came out on 60 Minutes.
Yeah, he sort of did, although for those of us familiar with Robert Bigelow, we know he was into some interesting ideas prior to this. But for a little bit of background, Robert Bigelow, an American businessman, he owns the hotel chain Budget Suites of America, and he is also the founder of Bigelow Aerospace. So he has a vast fortune, and he's using a good chunk of that fortune towards his aerospace company. Now, the Bigelow Aerospace manufactures and develops expandable space station modules. So Bigelow sort of took it over, and he's invested a lot of money since then, since 2000, in this contract. And he's got about $250 million of his own money into it, and he's going to go up to reportedly $500 million to try to make this a go. And it's in itself, it's really interesting technology. You basically send these habitats up either into space or onto another moon or a planet or something, and then you inflate it once it arrives at its destination. So that in itself is very interesting. However, also, as you alluded to, Steve, he did an interview recently on 60 Minutes just this past week, or 2 weeks ago now, and he had some interesting things to say, not only about his technology and his partnership with NASA, but also about his strong belief in aliens, extraterrestrials. And we're not talking about it in the context of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, the SETI project, or other people who are curious about intelligent life being somewhere else in the universe. He believes that aliens have visited the Earth, are currently on the Earth, and are really right under our noses. All we have to do is, you know, open our eyes and take a look for them. So his story goes that, you know, it was his grandparents apparently had some sort of close encounter with a UFO, and he was very fascinated with this ever since he was a child, and that was it. He was off on his belief in aliens. From the actual interview on 60 Minutes, I'll give you a couple of the lines. Laura Logan was the interviewer. She asked him, "Do you believe in aliens?" He replies, "I'm absolutely convinced that's all there is to it." And Laura Logan replies, "Do you also believe that UFOs have come to Earth?" And Bigelow replies, "There has been and is an existing presence, an ET presence. I've spent millions and millions and millions. I probably spent more as an individual than anybody else in the United States has ever spent on this subject." And then Laura Logan asks, "Is it risky for you to say this in public that you believe in UFOs and aliens?" And Bigelow replies, "I don't give a damn. I don't care." And it basically goes on like that. And what I got out of this is that even though you're scientifically inclined in certain ways, you know, certainly for him to take his fortune from hotels and turn it into sort of this other aerospace company and want to do some great technological advances in regards to that, that's really great. And he seems to understand science to some certain level. But at the same time, he has this sacred cow about aliens that he refuses to let go. Yeah. He has no interest in learning more about it or letting go. He doesn't want his mind to be changed. He doesn't want to think about it any more than he's already thought about it. He is sold lock, stock, and barrel. And we have seen this far too many times occur with other people in positions similar to his.
Yeah, so they interviewed Seth Shostak for this article, you know, writing about it on Live Science, and he brings up a good point. It's like, yeah, you know, we have pretty thorough satellite surveillance of the planet at this point. It'd be kind of hard to sneak in and out, you know, if you were an alien. It's increasingly less likely that aliens are actively visiting the Earth and there's no solid or convincing evidence. Of course, you never prove a negative, but then the believers just say, well, the aliens are too good at hiding from us. Okay, then you don't know that they're here. You can't have it both ways.
Right.
If they're that good at hiding from us, then we don't know, and that's it. But you can't say, I know they're here, but they're hiding from us so that we can't have any evidence that they're here. Well, then you don't know.
That's right. It's the invisible dragon analogy from Carl Sagan's Demon Haunted
World. It's special pleading. Yeah, it's special pleading. But that's all they got. They got special pleading.
And that's all they got. And like I said at the beginning, for those of us who have heard of Robert Bigelow before the 60 Minutes interview, he said some things like this, you know, well before. In fact, back in 2009 even, Skeptical Inquirer wrote a little article about it and about him in particular, that he has a long history in the matter of UFOs and other paranormal subjects. For example, in 2004, he purchased a ranch out in Utah in which it was supposedly haunted, and he believes that it's some kind of hyperdimensional portal area or a stargate. And the ranch is said to be infested by an alien or paranormal shape-shifting creature known as a skinwalker. Taking its name from Native American legends similar to European legends about werewolves and these sorts of things.
It's odd, right? You have this guy spending, $250 million to do something that I love, right? You know, he wants to invest in space. Great. But man, the fact that he's so kooky, I just don't feel good that he's driving the money.
Yeah, it has a little bit of a, almost a Howard Hughes sort of feel to him.
Yeah, but it is disappointing.
It is.
When you do encounter it.
Agreed.
All right, Kara, why do doctors have to warn women not to put bees in their vagina?
What?
What the hell?
Huh? Yeah. So it is bad. It's not as bad as like live bees in the vagina, but it is pretty bad.
Oh my gosh.
There, I found a few different write-ups. There's one in the New York Post. There's one in Popular Science. There's one in Forbes. But they really are all just citing the same blog post from Dr. Jen Gunter. And Dr. Jen Gunter is an OB who, you know, tries to fight back against woo when it comes to women's vaginas. And she's done a great job on her blog post. She has spoken historically about the vaginal steaming trend that you might remember, the jade eggs in the vagina that Gwyneth Paltrow was pushing on Goop. Actually, the subhead on her WordPress blog is Dr. Jen Gunter wielding the lasso of truth. So this is a nice Wonder Woman reference.
Hey,
I know, it's great. And so she wrote a blog post basically about this new trend. She likes to scan the internet for trends of, you know, bad recommendations. And there's a new one, and it involves wasp galls. Have you guys heard of these? They're these small, they look like little rocks, but they're definitely botanical in nature, also called oak galls. And what happens is that wasp larvae will actually, or wasps, I should say, gall wasps, that's what they're called, and they're specifically big fans of oak trees, will puncture into the top layer of an oak tree and deposit its larvae. And because the larvae are actually an irritant for the tree secretes these acids that form like a nut, or sometimes you'll hear it called an oak apple, and it forms around the larva, and they look like these little botanical hard balls, oak galls, oak apples, wasp galls, all these different euphemisms for them. And of course, the Indian euphemism, and the one that's often used when these things are sold online, quote unquote, medicinally, is manjakani. I think that's how you would pronounce it, or manjakani. The problem is these little larval balls are made out of tannins, and they're also made out of gallic acid. And if you put these in your vagina in any form, if you grind them up and make a paste, if you put them in intact, however you want to put them in your vagina, they have two outcomes. Now, unfortunately, it's the actual outcomes that people are selling online as being beneficial when they are anything but. The first outcome is that they're highly astringent, so they tend to burn. And I love this quote from Dr. Gunter here. Her quote is, "Here's a pro tip. If something burns when you apply it to the vagina, it is generally bad for the vagina," which I think is a good pro tip to take home.
Yeah.
Yeah, generally speaking. And so the thing is, in a Popular Science post, they went into the history of this, and it started to come into focus a little bit. Apparently, in certain parts of the world, especially Southeast Asia, there's a long history of using these oak galls post-childbirth. And it seems that the historical reason for that is because they are astringent. They may have something, a little bit of an antimicrobial property. Now, that it's nothing compared to an actual antibiotic, so please keep that in mind. So it could be that post-childbirth, historically, women might use a paste made from these things in their traditional quote-unquote medicine in order to try and prevent infection. And somehow that practice became bastardized into a vaginal tightening practice. Because, of course, when you put this stuff down there, it dries it out. And when you dry out your vagina, it feels as if it is being tightened. The problem is that's going to give you exactly the opposite of what you're actually looking for if you're the kind of person who feels that they need, which is a huge bummer. And I feel like there's something to say about patriarchal kind of views here. But beyond that, if you're the kind of person who feels compelled to want to tighten your vagina, the worst way to do it would be to take all of the moisture out of it and cause it to be dry. Of course, that'll make it feel tighter. But then if you do engage engage in sex, what's going to happen is you're going to rip all these little holes. You're going to have all these abrasions running through your vagina that will A, hurt, B, could cause infection, and C, could cause, could exacerbate your risk or increase your risk of sexually transmitted infections. We know that the risk of HIV is higher if you have a lot of abrasions where you are then exposed to the virus. And so this is a really, really dangerous thing to do and could cause much worse consequences than what you're hoping for. So A, it's going to dry you out, could cause these abrasions, and B, it's potentially going to burn. And the truth of the matter is, you don't need vaginal rejuvenation. You don't need vaginal tightening. And if you are interested in that because there is a real medical reason for it, there are Kegel exercises and there are legitimate medical approaches that you can use that you can talk to your gynecologist about. Now, I found a website where they're selling these. They used to have an Etsy post. That's what a lot of people were writing around, but the Etsy post has since been taken down. But you can find them on Amazon. They're often sold under the Mankajani name, or Manjikani, I said that backward name, vaginal tightening lubricant, vaginal tightening galls, vaginal tightening pills. Be like a virgin again. Drive him wild. It really works. He'll love you more. So sad. And this one website, vaginal-tightening.com, the very top line on the website is feel tight and wanted again. So wow. I feel like this has a double negative connotation, right? Because A, it's a very dangerous thing that women could be engaging in. But B, it's just kind of promoting this idea of sort of a cultural norm that being virginal and being very young is the only way to be attractive, which is absolutely not the truth. So I think it's a bummer on multiple levels, and I would heed the advice of Dr. Gunter and a lot of other gynecologists who have spoken out against these pseudoscientific woo treatments. You don't need to tighten your vagina. And definitely don't go about it this way.
But that is a theme that we see a lot in alternative medicine, where there's a treatment that has a negative effect. It's painful or whatever. And then, you know, that is justified with some hand waving explanation. That's a good thing, you know, that's happening. No matter what happens. Yeah, no matter what happens, it's always interpreted as a good sign. And unfortunately, you know, we do a lot in medicine that is unpleasant, you know, like even, you know, getting a vaccination or a lot of diagnostic tests or whatever, you get your blood drawn.
Or even like, just getting a pap smear. We're not used to, when we talk about the vagina in a medical sense, it's usually not pleasant. It's true.
Yeah. So unfortunately, I do think that like people are prepared to accept that a legitimate medical treatment could be unpleasant up front for the benefit. But that unfortunately sets them up to be gullible or to accept claims like, yeah, that burning sensation that you're feeling, that's a good thing. You know, when in fact your common sense tells you that's not a good thing. That's why, you know, we have to have evidence of risk versus benefit. You know, we need to know that it's not hurting and it's helping before we would justify the upfront discomfort or side effects or whatever. But when you don't have that evidence and you just have the burning, that's not a good thing.
And also, beyond not having the evidence that it helps, we actually do have some evidence that it could be harmful. And beyond the two things I mentioned, there's two that I completely forgot. One is basically anything that claims to, you know, change the pH balance or to clean out toxins, all of these different phrases that they use, like douche, are actually really dangerous for a woman. Yeah, because you could be washing out the bacteria that's quite necessary. You could be inducing yeast infections when you do that, or causing yourself to be more primed for a different kind of bacterial infection. So A, you have to be careful of that. And B, another thing that we have to remember is that you shouldn't put things in your vagina that haven't passed strict medical standards and are not sterile, because that is the cause of toxic shock syndrome. You guys remember that big scare when I was quite young,
the
80s. Because women because women were leaving tampons in for too long, or they were putting things in as tampons that weren't sterile. And the truth of the matter is, if you get this harmful bacteria built up and you force it in place for an extended period of time, you could get a terrible bacterial, you could go septic and it can be deadly. And so you've got to be really, really careful with, this is an orifice that has lots of capillaries. It's very easy to get things into your bloodstream through your vagina. So you have to be super careful not to leave anything in your vagina for longer than it's supposed to be there and not to put anything in that hasn't been medically sterilized.
Kara, are you saying I need to sterilize my penis?
Well, it is a good idea also. OBs do warn that after you have unprotected sex, you should definitely always urinate because that can help as well. So there are things that you can do even when you have a dirty penis going in there to make sure that you're protected.
You just need to be sterilized.
Yeah. Okay, Jay, who's that noisy? Who's that noisy?
Sterilize. Who's that noisy?
Last week, I played this sound. Weird and kind of pretty, huh?
Yeah, it's like harmonic. It has a musical aspect to it.
Star Trek-y. Transporter-y.
Yeah, it's a transporter mouthpiece.
Very slow transport.
All right, well, there was no winner this week because we're recording about 30 hours after this podcast was released.
Nobody figured it out yet.
Yeah, because Steve is going on vacation. So, to my who's that noisy crowd out there, I'm not mad. I'm just a little upset. That's all. So I'll remind you that Jacob Lutzen sent this one in, and here's what Jacob wrote. Now, I did get some people emailing other stuff in, but let me tell you what it is first, and then we'll talk about the guesses. Jacob wrote, thank you for a fantastic show, my all-time favorite podcast. I think I have a great one for you. It's a video where a composer demonstrates an extended piano technique, which involves holding down the pedal. The initial release of the pedal also agitates the strings, which provides an important initial vibration. She then uses some plastic, like an old cassette tape box, and pushes it down onto the strings while she slowly slides it up the strings lengthwise. The strings start to pick up the self-resonance in different overtones and fall in and out of it, sometimes with a fade and sometimes with a crackle. Very, very, very cool. It just couldn't think that a piano would make that noise. However, this listener, Ross Beckman, said, hey, Rogues, first time, long time. This week's noisy reminds me of the sound that's produced when drawing a violin or cello bow over a metal instrument like a chime or vibraphone.
Very close.
Close. Good, very good guess, Ross. I mean, it does. If you've heard it before, you kind of remember that tone. There's a tonal quality to it that has like a metal string, a bowed metal string thing to it. So, very good guess. You didn't get it all the way, but close enough. So you're pretty much this week's winner without being the winner.
You're such a jerk, Jay.
I know. I'm a man based on precision. Okay. So Ross was close, but not close enough. That's all. He knows what I'm talking about. Dudley Story said, hi, folks. I suspect that this week's noisy is the Star Trek transporter sound from the original series, extended and or pitch shifted. Great show as always. I love this guess, of course. I mean, Dudley may have guessed I'm a huge Star Trek fan. It did have that sound, and I tried. I didn't find anything that said where the transporter sound came from definitively, but I did try to figure out exactly where it came from. I do suspect that it may have used an instrument like this to do the sound, without a doubt.
That's too close not to. Come on.
So I have a new noisy this week. I predict this one will annoy Kara.
A theremin.
Come in, Covenant. You're breaking up. You're breaking up. Repeat.
What? A talking seal.
I thought that was so cool. This was sent in by Steve French. It's weird, but there is something kind of fun about it, though, right?
Yeah.
So if you have a guess or you have an awesome noisy that you encountered this week, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thank you, Jay. Well, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for
science or fiction?
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You have a theme this week, which you should have been able to predict since you have such a rapid turnover. We're doing the show so early. There hasn't been enough time for there to be new news items. So, the theme this week is trees. What do you know about trees?
It's pretty broad.
Well, it comes, you know, after trees. Twos and or before twos and after fours.
Yeah.
Evan, no.
What? You're all thinking it. I just said it.
No, we weren't, actually. Okay. Here we go. Three tree items. Item number one. Plants use three different types of photosynthesis, C3, C4, and CAM, which stands for crassulation acid metabolism. But almost all trees use the less efficient C3 cycle. All right, number two, a 206-acre stand of aspirin trees in Utah is actually a single organism weighing 6 million kilograms and estimated to be 80,000 years old. And item number three, the dragon's blood tree has deep red sap that has been used for centuries as a medicinal and a varnish and contains a powerful hallucinogen similar in chemistry and effect to LSD. Evan, go first.
All right, the first one, three different types of photosynthesis. C3, C4, and CAM. Didn't know that. I wasn't taught that. That wasn't part of my high school you know, science classes. I don't know. this could very well be fiction, just flat out. I would have absolutely really no way of knowing this. The number two, aspen trees in Utah is actually a single organism weighing 6 million kilograms and 80,000 years old. And it's 206 acres in spread out size, but it is a single organism. Well, is the I imagine so it's something along the lines of maybe something like a coral reef. It's that considered, I think, a organism unto itself, and that spreads over thousands of miles in some cases. So something like this existing, the weight, sure, the age, possibly, sure, okay. That's fascinating. I think it's going to be right. Then there's this dragon's blood tree. Sap has been used for centuries as a medicinal and a varnish and contains a powerful hallucinogen similar in chemistry and effect to LSD. Never heard of it. Yeah, multi-purpose, medicinal, varnish, sure. Hallucinogen, I don't see any problem with that. Plenty of plants that meet those qualities, so I don't think there's anything wrong with this. I don't think it's going to turn out to be a single organism, but I think something else, you know, the other aspects of this might be correct. But I don't think they're going to be calling it a single organism, so I'll say that one's the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Let's see. Yeah, not aware of these different types of photosynthesis, but it kind of makes sense. And I could see if you're going to be inefficient, I could see a tree kind of being inefficient. I mean, there's just so many leaves, so much surface area. And I know there's a lot of mass there to support, but it sounds plausible. The dragon's blood tree, number three. Yeah, I'm a little surprised. I, you know, hadn't heard of that before, especially, you know, a tree whose sap is like LSD. You'd think that would have come up at some point. But the one that really rubbed me wrong immediately was number two, the 206-acre aspen trees. Single organism? No, I don't think so. I do know that there's a lot of amazing and fascinating things going on under the ground with these trees, and that they could have some sort of chemical communication with each other. I totally would buy that. But in terms of them being just one organism, one clone, sure, it's possible, but 80,000 years old. I mean, yeah, I just think they can communicate, but it's not one big organism. So I'll say that's fiction.
Okay, Kara.
Okay, C3, C4, and CAM plants are real. There are three types of photosynthesis. CAM and C4 are really not rare, but they make up a lot less of the biomass of the Earth. This I remember. Like CAM, I think, are like desert plants, like succulents. I used to teach intro bio, and so I remember some of this stuff just from my knowledge. I think C3, most trees are C3, because I think most of the biomass, like plant biomass on Earth, is C3. So I would assume that plants would fit into that. So if I'm wrong on this one, I'm wrong on this one. It's just because I'm switching C3 and C4, but I think it is C3. I actually think there are clonal trees, but I don't know, an aspen tree is one of them. I mean, this one sounds the most crazy, which makes me think that it's real. I actually kind of think this is going to be science. So, but let me see if I can convince myself why the third one would be fiction.
Even if they're clones, right. that doesn't make them one organism.
Yeah, Kara.
A single
identical
organism.
Identical twins are clones.
No, but a clonal organism is a bunch of individual, like, it's a colony. It's like a jellyfish. Like, it's all the different organisms inside the jellyfish that make up one organism. That's what I think he could mean to make this one correct. Let's see. And then the dragon's blood tree has a deep red sap that's been used for centuries as a medicinal and a varnish. Gosh, that sounds like it could be true. Contains a powerful hallucinogen, similar in chemistry and effect to LSD. That to me, because I know about DMT, I know about psilocybin. I don't know of another, and I know, yeah, DMT is peyote, psilocybin from mushrooms. I don't know about another hallucinogen from a tree. I know about other types of drugs. Like there's a tree in the Galapagos that is kind of like marijuana, but it doesn't have a hallucinogen effect. And that's the part that's bugging me. So I'm going to say just because, and that's why I'm going to say the dragon's blood tree is the fiction.
Okay. And Jay.
All right. So this one about plants using C3, C4, or CAM. You know, Steve, everybody knows that plants do not use C4. That is a military-grade explosive.
Thank you.
So I find this ridiculous. But since Kara, you know, talked like intelligently and sounded like she knew what she was saying, I will agree with her. That one is science, of
Jay,
course.
They also call that the PO photosynthesis system.
C3PO. Hey.
Very good.
That one, Steve.
This second one here reminds me. Now, I know Steve Novella pretty damn well. And I know lots of things about Steve that most people don't know. Like, Steve wrote a D&D campaign where there were three trees that covered, like, this entire planet that he wrote. And no one knew it was just three trees, but there was three organisms. I knew about that, and I have read about things like this in the past. So this doesn't sound strange to me. You know, I think it's strange because they're talking about an aspen tree, which is a tree that I'm familiar with. So I don't see – I kind of see it like those trees that have the tendrils that go into the ground, but it's not that kind of tree. But it has to be that their roots are connected. That's it. That's what I think, if that's true. I'm on a roll here. This last one, dragon's blood. It's a it's tree sap. It's a varnish. It's a dessert topping. It's got LSD in it. It's basically something that you can wax your car with. All these crazy things that it does. The one that actually I find the least believable is the varnish aspect of it. I get the medicinal properties. I can understand the hallucinogenic properties, but the varnish property of the tree sap to me doesn't seem like it would have the properties of what I think a varnish should be doing. Well, I'm going with the dragon's blood as the fake.
All right, so you all agree with the first one, so we'll start there. Plants use three different types of photosynthesis, C3, C4, and CAM, but
and
almost
C-fly.
All trees use the less efficient C3 cycle. You all think this one is science, and this one is science. That one is
Yay!
True.
Yay!
And you know what was helpful on this, Steve, is that you said almost all.
Why?
Almost
if you had said all trees, then I would have been like, ooh, that's going to stick out. That could be a fiction.
Yeah,
you
so
hedged.
That's because it's not all trees.
Yeah.
Because I looked it up. So I always try to vet any of these facts as much as possible because I know I have 300,000 people who are going to vet it for me after the show. So C3 is the basic photosynthesis that you all learned in school, and most plants use that, you know, pretty much the direct conversion of sunlight and CO2 and water into oxygen and plant food. C4 is more efficient because it concentrates the carbon, and it does that by taking the CO2 and converting it into certain molecules. CAM uses similar chemistry to C4, but for a different reason. And you're right, Kara. CAM is found in plants that are in dry, arid locations, like succulents.
Oh, yay!
And the reason is that, you know, plants will lose like 98% of the water that they suck up through their roots. They will lose through transpiration, right? They'll just lose it through their leaves, through the pores, you know. What plants in hot, dry places do is they close their pores during the day so they don't lose so much water. But that means they don't have access to CO2. Then they open their pores at night. They suck up all the delicious CO2. And then they convert that CO2 into the C4 molecules, the same kind of molecules used in C4 photosynthesis, so that as a storage, just as a storage mechanism, and then it uses that CO2 during the day when it has sunlight to make food and oxygen. Does that make
sense? Isn't it amazing that they evolved the ability to like outsmart Mother Nature? I love it.
Yeah, very cool. So a lot, there's one of the big things that uses C4, the more efficient photosynthesis is corn. So that's part of why corn is such a staple crop. But there are researchers working to see if they can genetically modify other staple crops like wheat and upgrade them from C3 to C4. And then boom, you get a 10 or 20% boost to your productivity.
Or maybe even C5.
Yeah, so that would be huge if they could figure out how to do that. Genetically engineer all crop plants, you know, basically to be C4, upgrade them from C3. Because it is more efficient. Produce more plant per acre, basically. Okay, let's go on to number two. A 206-acre stand of aspen trees in Utah is actually a single organism weighing 6 million kilograms and estimated to be 80,000 years old. Bob and Evan think this one is the fiction. Jay and Kara think this one is science. And this one is science.
Shit.
Oh, my God, baby.
Yeah.
Good job, Kara. High five.
80,000 years would have been the bit that got me.
That is insane.
Yeah.
Like, but I know that there are some really, really old things on this planet that always blow my mind when I find
out. Well, and this is the kind of things that's really old because no individual piece of it lasts that long. They're like 130, 140 years old. But the overall organism is just ongoing. It just lasts until something kills
it. Wait, how is it one organism?
There's two ways. One is that it's been they've genetically analyzed the different trees and they have identical genetic markers. So this is a clonal colony of a single male quaking aspen, Populus tremuloides, also called the trembling giant, is the sort of nickname for this stand of trees.
Why? Do they look like they're dancing in the wind or something?
I don't know. Probably.
Yeah, probably. And the
suspicion is, I guess they haven't really proved this yet, but they think that there's just one massive underground root system. As Jay said, all the roots.
Wow.
It's one root system that just sends up trees from different parts of it.
All right, because now.
But they're all connected.
I recently had a discussion with my daughter Ashley, who just finished her first year at UVM, and we talked about trees, and we talked about topics related to this specifically. And a lot of trees, their root systems will actually stop before kind of merging or messing with another tree's root systems. They kind of know where to stop, but some trees can communicate chemically to actually warn each other of shit going down. So that's why this made me, made me think. So this is one of the exceptions, of course, that it's one, you know, they're all,
it's actually a colony.
Because they didn't grow together. They grew out of the same thing.
Right.
It's one root
system.
That's
the key right there. That's the key.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bob, when I was doing research for this segment, I also discovered there was a study that showed that sometimes older trees will give nutrients to younger trees to help them grow. And then the younger trees are mature and the older trees are aged, they'll return the favor. They'll give them nutrients back to help them at the end of their life cycle.
That's fascinating. Steve, is the idea here that, like, because you can do vegetative propagation to grow plants, like you don't actually have to breed plants, you can just, like, for certain plants, you can lop some of it off and just plant it, and then it's a clone of a clone of a clone. Is it similar in that way? Like, it itself is propagating over and over?
Yeah, I think so. It's just, it's a clonal colony, so which is considered a single organism. But its life cycle is just to constantly renew itself. Yeah.
That so is it's so not, cool.
So it's not this dropping kind of, acorns or seeds or any of that, right?
No, it spreads.
None of that's happening.
No, it doesn't.
So this is how you hack immortality.
Yeah, it just spreads.
You become clonal.
Well, yeah, it's like that. Isn't there a jelly that just lives forever? Just
like the Hydra. It just keeps going back into, its like juvenile state.
The thing is, so it becomes reborn in a sense, but basically you have to forget it's not worth it because who the hell wants, you don't remember anything. You know, it's just like, it's not.
Yeah, it wouldn't work for people. Right. Like if we went through the same process, your memories wouldn't pass to the new version of you, the baby version of you.
Which is annoying. That sucks.
Yeah. But you could maybe download all of those memories and then once you're old enough to understand them, re-upload them.
I'll figure out another way.
Yeah, okay.
We'll work on that. Cool. All right. All of this means that the dragon's blood tree has deep red sap that has been used for centuries as a medicinal and a varnish and contains a powerful hallucinogen similar in chemistry and effect to LSD is fiction, but there is a dragon's blood tree with deep red sap and it's from Yemen. It's actually a very beautiful, interesting looking tree. It looks like an umbrella almost, like it's just all the branches reach up and then there's this umbrella shaped canopy on top. Very interesting looking.
It has what about the varnish?
So, all right, but the locals think of it, they call it dragon's blood, they think it cures everything, but because it's a deep red color, it has been used in paint. I don't know if it might not be fair to say that it is a varnish, it's mixed with varnish to create a red varnish. And in fact, so I didn't have to worry about it because this is the fiction, so whether, I could just, make it wrong and it's okay. But the red color of a violin, it comes from this varnish used with the dragon's blood tree. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. It's so pretty. I just Googled it.
Yeah. It's very pretty.
Not just is the tree pretty, but the sap is insane.
Yeah.
It's like the tree bleeds when you cut into it.
Exactly. I made up the whole part about the LSD because that part's not correct. Because they take it for everything, so they're not getting high every time they use it to treat whatever their diarrhea, whatever they're using it for.
Oh, yeah. How could it be medicinal and also make them trip balls?
Yeah, right. Yeah, so that was one of that was
the tree. It looks like it's bleeding.
Crazy.
I know. Yeah,
very pretty. There are so many. I was just looking at gorgeous trees prepping for this item. There are so many unbelievable trees.
Yeah, what's that one? It's like the boa. Is that what it's called?
Baobab tree?
Baobab tree. Yeah, I'm obsessed with that tree.
I know. Baobab. It's like this massive trunk and these little branches on top.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite's a banyan tree.
Yeah,
they can be big mothers. Oh, my God.
And look at like the largest wisteria tree in the world. It looks like something out of Avatar, out of Pandora. It's gorgeous.
I'm looking at this dragon's blood tree. I don't see any goats in it.
No goats.
No goats.
Oh, that's beautiful, Steve. The wisteria. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And then, of course, every time I drive to Joshua Tree and I see the Joshua Tree out there,
I've seen the Joshua
I always trees. Think, like, did Dr. Seuss visit this place before he wrote The Lorax? Like, this inspire him? Because it's so fun when you see these things in nature that are so Seussian.
Yeah, I know. I love trees. Trees are awesome.
Yeah, really cool.
Okay, Evan, give us a quote.
Innumeracy and pseudoscience are often associated, in part because of the ease with which mathematical certainty can be invoked to bludgeon the innumerate into a dumb acquiescence. And that was written by John Allen Paulos.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, he's a mathematics professor. He is also a member of the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry. And we've run into him at a few amazing meetings here and there in the past.
Yeah.
Yep, and he talks a lot about how people's innumeracy or lack of understanding mathematics, mathematical illiteracy, as he puts it, leads you to all sorts of crazy stuff, and is part of the calling card of pseudoscientists everywhere because they just get it so wrong, they get the math so wrong that they can come up with anything they want to explain their claims.
Yeah, it's like multi-level marketing wouldn't exist unless people were mathematically illiterate.
Hey, speaking of Nexus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Coming up very quickly, just a couple weeks.
Really soon, yeah.
A few weeks, June 29th to July 2nd. This is going to be at FIT in New York City. And Brian Wecht, a good friend of ours, is he's one of my favorite comedians, one of my favorite all-time just people that I love to do conference-like things with, because Brian and I have been doing workshops with each other every year for the past few years at Nexus. Why should you come and see Brian Wecht? Well, where else can you see the world's only ninja to hold a PhD in particle physics?
Yeah, that's right.
He is Brian is part of the what's the name of Brian's band? Steve?
Ninja Sex Party.
Ninja Sex Party. Brian is a founding member of Ninja Sex Party. You can see him in his ninja costume and music set to the 80s. Very awesome. Fun facts about Brian. He was a faculty member at Queen Mary University of London, where he worked on a string theory, supersymmetry, and quantum field theory. Another cool fact, with his bands Ninja Sex Party and Starbomb, Brian has released 6 albums, 3 of which have reached number 1 on the Billboard Comedy Chart. Mm-hmm. That's amazing, Brian. Oh my god. And the last fact I have here is he's a cast member on the YouTube video gaming channel Game Grumps.
Game Grumps.
Has over 3 million subscribers. Brian Weck is joining me and Steve for our I have 2 workshops with Brian this year, but the one I'm really excited about is the one about best moments and most impactful moments in sci-fi movies and TV. So we're going to show clips about, you know, just our favorite moment, and we're going to discuss it in as much time and energy as we can.
Why are they iconic? Exactly.
And I have a cool announcement. We've added one more person to that list of people that will be doing that workshop. Sci-fi writer Brian Trent will be coming down to Nexus to join us for that discussion.
Awesome.
Really? You didn't tell me that Brian's coming.
Great addition.
This was my way of telling you. Yeah. I Brian today.
Yeah, Brian's
I invited
awesome.
Him. Yeah, we were looking for someone
better
that
than all you guys.
Yeah, he like Steve was so funny because I was telling him about Nexus and he was like, what are you talking about this year? I tell him. So I saw his eyes perk up when I said, you know, we're going to be plucking these awesome moments out of sci-fi movies and TV shows. So then he gives me his list and I'm like, yeah, you have to do this with us, because he like just rattled off, like it was like right on the tip of his tongue. It was amazing. So he's coming. He's going to be great. What a perfect addition to the cast. And
actually
please,
a sci-fi writer, Brian, is what he does.
He is a sci-fi writer, yes. Mm-hmm. He is actually in the 3 largest sci-fi markets right now. He is published right now in those 3 markets. He is really, really, really good.
Yeah, whenever we were just together yesterday, you know, I was over at Jay's, and he's always hitting me up for, like, all right, Steve, I mean, ask you a question. And he's like, all right, let's say you're in a system like the TRAPPIST system, right? And he's trying to get the physics and the astronomy correct, so he's writing a story about it. And we're talking about like what a civilization would be like on a world like this. It's awesome. You'll love having those conversations with him.
Yeah, he's so into it. That's the thing. Yeah, he gets so excited about it. If you're interested, please join us June 29th to July 2nd at FIT in NYC.
Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure. Thanks, Doc.
Thanks, Steve. Travel safely.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org. where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.